Good evening. This is module 17, looking at self and selflessness. This is class 11 wrap up, and it's February 23rd, 2017. So.
I'm enlightened already.
Actually,
you are.
Big Buddha secret. So this has been quite some heavy lifting we've been doing, I think. Fantastic work, really. We started looking at self and selflessness because these are words that we use constantly, and it was about time to specify what we were talking about and to know exactly what we're talking about, which is a core issue of the Buddhist path, in fact. So, again, I've written here, basically this is an outline of sorts into what we've covered in the past many weeks.
Wow, since November, I think. End of November?
We were planning in October, I guess.
Yeah.
So. It's been a really long time working on this material, and we've had wonderful assistance. Thank you, Sandra. And John was here, if you remember, to teach a class, guide us in a class. And I think we've exposed ourselves to material that is going to come back again and again the rest of our lives as practitioners. I have a confession to make, which is that I learn this, I study it, I think I understand it, and then I forget immediately everything that I learn and have to feel as though I have to relearn the skandhas again and again and where the consciousness is fitting, and so on and so forth. So that is me. It's not my fault. But that is my experience. But over time and over our life as practitioners, we're going to return again and again to this material and hear it in different ways, and it's going to penetrate our awareness and understanding in different ways, and that's as it should be. Because that's the nature of the path itself. So I just thought we could just read through this outline. You are welcome and invited to ask any questions of the four of us. I'm more like your host, host of ceremony.
Master of ceremonies.
Your master of ceremonies. But all we're here essentially to embarrass him. Embarrass me. No, really, it's for all four. This is more of a panel, and let's all talk together about issues that come up. So if that suits you, we'll do that. And then at the very end, there's a kind of charming little exercise we can do, which is titled "The 12 Nidanas Go to a Party." Go to a bar. I've actually written "go to a bar" here, but a party or a bar. So we'll do that as well. So we began with the questions of what is self? Is it permanent or is it impermanent? Is it solid or singular? And we use the word lumping, as in we lump characteristics together and call them a thing. We call them us, or we call them Harry Bob, or we call them those people, or we call them... We sort of approach our whole world by actually limiting our communication with it by solidifying ourselves and what we're engaged in. So is it solid, singular or lumping, or is it a composite situation? Is it open, fluid, or dynamic? Rhetorical question. Is it, are we separate and independent from each other and the world, or are we interconnected and unable to centralize or pin down either ourselves or the world? So we had a discussion about that, and we then followed that with methods to investigate. How do we know what our conclusion is? We did some contemplations. We did analytical meditation techniques, watching the Tyler Durer film where we saw Emily in the background or in the foreground asking questions. And we worked with our contemplation and analytical meditation to sort of pry ourselves from the clinging to any ideas we might have about our own identity, what makes us up. We did the meditations on our body, for example. Do we like parts of ourselves? Do we dislike parts of ourselves? If I don't like my nose, does that mean that I dislike me, or is it, does it define me? What is us? The old traditional one is, if you cut off your arm, are you still you? Where do you reside in your body?
Well, are you your body?
Are you your body? And if so, where? Where in your body are you? Were you asking?
I'm raising the question.
Positing. We further. Does anybody want to respond to that, or do we want to keep going?
Actually, I had a question. The Tyler Durer tape. Does someone? It's not a tape.
It's a video. Yes, audio. Now it's not a DVD.
It's a DVD. Do you own that?
Yes, I own it. If people want to borrow it, yeah, they could borrow it from me. I can sign it out.
That would actually be great to see again and again.
Yeah, I could also. I think I captured the audio from at least one of those DVDs, and that might be something I could. That would be possible to put up some of that content. On the website.
That would be wonderful.
The audio, because basically, you can sort of have a picture of somebody sitting.
Right.
Use that as the video.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that would be great. Because some people didn't get to just hear that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We also discussed who we are when we receive criticism or blame versus who we are when we receive praise, and how our world contracts or expands under those conditions.
Although I felt like when John did that exercise that I wasn't giving the expected response, because I think that was like contracts or expands, and I felt that in my case it expanded in both cases. That it didn't really, it was the same, maybe different quality, but that it was the emotional quality didn't change the direction of the reaction. In my experience.
That's interesting, and it could be really interesting to examine that on the spot, actually as it occurs, with a more dispassionate view, if that's possible, on the spot. Say, Peter gets mad at you for something. How do you... So this is just something you might experiment
with. Peter, why am I in this exercise?
Randomly
or vice versa.
Yeah.
To see, actually, rather than responding habitually, what does that actually feel like? And how does our sense of our self alter or change. And you're right to say that perhaps expand or contract aren't necessarily the only words we can use to describe what this is. But certainly our sense of, does it affect our sense of confidence or a sense of place? Or how does it affect one's view of oneself as one thing or another thing on the spot? I think, and ultimately we're all going, the whole point of this is to be on the spot. The whole point of this is that we are on the spot right now, and right now, and right now. And we always have this remarkable opportunity to see what's actually true on this spot.
I think what's interesting about some of these contemplations is that for me, it's just like poking little holes in the whole solidification of it. It's not like it just crumbles all at once, or there's some big, you know, the self is now crumbled down to nothing or something. It's just like that sort of little, you know, wait a minute, you know, I don't feel like myself today. Now that
what
is
does that
weird,
mean? Right?
Really. And do we question those phrases that we use all the time? And it just feels like little by little there's some inroad, although that we carry, you know, I just carry the concept of self all the time, but now there's a little more questioning to the whole thing. And just, I don't know, it's not like it's just some gigantic, you know, now it's going to fall apart.
But you do bring up the point of sort of we use language all the time as though our self, I'm going to make a better self.
Right.
Right. When I lose weight, I'll be more me. I'll be a better self.
Right.
Or when I, you know, win the Academy Award or whatever, then I'm really, now that I'm really here, or I've really made it, I'm truly existent. And we sort of use that, these references all the time.
And that we carry that structure with us all the time. And that we all have our own structure that we are trying to live up to.
Yeah, the phrase being true to oneself, you know, the notion that that's, you know, that doesn't, you can do something that isn't true to yourself. That,
yeah, I like that one.
I keep thinking of that. I'm not sure if I'm remembering exactly correctly, but Sandra, you were saying you felt that expansion of self with both criticism and praise.
Yeah.
So Rudyard Kipling in the poem If, something about if you can deal with triumph and disaster and treat the two imposters just the same.
Ooh,
lovely. Yeah. It's a sort of stoic.
Yeah,
it's very nice.
Both are false. Both are
equally
self. It's my love.
I know. That's wonderful. I never heard that. Mm. From Rudyard Kipling.
Oh. You probably had to recite it at some point.
What poem is it?
If. You recited it at some point in grade school.
Right.
Yeah. I'm willing to forget.
So, again, the subject of rejecting and resisting that which is actually occurring. We sort of solidify and as though you can resist that which is actually occurring. We solidify and sort of hunker down into a concept of I like this, I don't like this, and because I don't like that, I'm not going to. What? What aren't you going to do? Exactly. We were talking about sort of developing the muscles that can enable one to hang out in the feeling of discomfort or lack of resolution. where everything isn't tied up with a little bow, that we can relax enough to experience what occurs with that dispassionate. Can we do that? Can we have a dispassionate view?
Sometimes.
So are we ever just one thing? And if we, I think this is more rhetorical, because clearly we aren't. And what changes? Or is there anything that doesn't change? So these are all contemplations that we can, that we worked on, the view that. An interesting article just came out. I think I sent it to you. There was a recent test done over a long period of time for young people up to their 70s, I believe it was, who described themselves over. It was a real longitudinal study. The language that people use to describe themselves at various stages of their lives, completely different. So the test was essentially: are there certain aspects of ourselves that are immutable, that always remain the same? And in this longitudinal study, they actually reference that maybe it's more like the Buddhist view that everything changes.
So it's basically about the self-image. I think I saw the same one.
Yeah. So I thought that was really kind of interesting. And we do see frequently scientific studies that confirm a lot of Buddhist view.
Could you share that article in the Google Doc?
Yeah. I'll send it to you and you can share it. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, very good. So we also discussed subtle impermanence. And the example was the candle flame. From the point of view of our habitual way of looking at a candle, we see the candle, we see the light. And we assume that the light is constant, the wick is constant, but of course every millisecond the light and the candle wick and the wax are changing and altering. But to our view, we just see candle. So even that is not solid. So seeing that our habitual patterns of thought interfere with our abilities to see things as they are. And we're constantly constructing and reconstructing our imputed self. I thought was pretty interesting. And mostly we're reconstituting so that we end up thinking we know ourselves and we're okay.
It just occurred to me, too, that, like hanging on to our resentments and it's sort of like, kind of negativity towards certain people, that's just another fixation that keeps you trapped. And being able to see through that is a real liberating experience. I think that's a real liberation. So I'm just thinking of all the other ways of self that I haven't really been thinking about until just now. It's interesting.
Yeah, and you can see how over time, even in your own physical presence, you see how you've changed and the things that you were so proud of. My gravity might have affected them. It's possible. They might not be the same as they once were. And you really thought that was you, that whatever your superpower, your youthy superpower was or is, was going to remain you. And clearly, things change.
The last sentence on that first page about the self-constructing and reconstructing self, one of the things that I've noticed to myself, and it relates to what you just said, too, about negative attitudes towards other people. What I'm finding is that it's not necessarily, sometimes it's negative, sometimes it's not even negative, it might be positive, but it's always some sense in order for myself to reconstruct itself, to re-impute itself. Mm-hmm. It seems that there has to be a sense of difference, of separation, and either it's, if it's about somebody else or other people around me, maybe it's they're a little better than I am, or maybe I'm a little better than they are, or I could have done that better. For a geek, that's a common one, by the way. I could have done that. There's some resistance there, always. Oh. There's something that's constructing a separation. Uh-huh. I remember Krishnamurti always, he wrote a book called Conflict, I think it was. And his belief was that the ego is constructed in conflict. Mm-hmm. And without conflict...
It's friction.
Yes, without that, which is the literal definition of dukkha. Mm.
Yes, right. Explain that to us.
And, yeah, it's like there's something frictive always going on there. It's a resistance to what is what it comes down to.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is one of the first things you were asking. What is it? You know, if I say, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to accept it. I'm not going to accept what? Reality. If I can keep myself from accepting the way things are, then that creates the necessary space and separation for the self to keep constructing itself. And then without that, it kind of melts. It starts to get more permeable and softer. That's my experience anyway.
Meditation serves as the WD-40.
Yeah, exactly.
I was afraid you would find that a perfect analogy. I'm sorry, I said that meditation serves as the WD-40.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're just declaring war on reality all the time, which is insane.
That rubbing yes. is really, then you've got to always have something to rub against.
Yeah.
That then right. it reconfirms.
Exactly.
Craving, yes. grasping. Just constant.
Yeah. And I think without that, if it were possible to live without that friction, I think that's no self. That's the end of the illusion of self.
How interesting that right now we're seeing this manifest on a world scale that as perhaps has occurred in my lifetime, but never that I've seen to this extent. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, that generation of conflict and friction creates other and creates suffering, and it goes around and around and around. Right.
And sometimes it's from a massive sense of lack.
Right, indeed.
I feel like I'm lacking so much that I have to
declare, conquer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you think that non-self brings up annihilation?
No. Because there's nothing real to be annihilated there. Mm-hmm. It's a sense of self. But my feeling about it, my sense of it, and sometimes a glimpses of it, are that when that falls away, it's the end of separation. And the end of separation is the real source of peace and love and compassion. I think that's where real compassion flows. Mm-hmm. Without that, it seems almost impossible to be truly compassionate.
So what happens at death? For example, take the Buddha, who no one well, the spew was not enlightened. Mm-hmm. So when an enlightened person dies, that identity is annihilated, or it was annihilated while the person was alive, and so he's enlightened. But what happens after enlightened? There is no self. I guess everything is somehow melted together.
Why do you need to speculate?
I'm agnostic about that myself. Okay. That's one of the great philosophical questions about which we can never know, I think.
One of the things I actually really like about Buddhist practice is that I'm not required to have a belief about death or what happens after death, yeah. If anything does. That nothing about my practice changes depending on what I believe about that.
Yeah, I don't think I'm not asking about a belief. I'm asking about, for example, the dynamics of this paradigm. Like we talked about the nidanas and changing the realms. Yeah, switching, somehow going between the realms. I guess not. The image I got from the audio last week and tonight was we are aware of others in different states. But we ourselves are switching states. You know, within ourselves, our self is jumping, quantum jumps to different states, I guess. So, at death, that activity stops. Let's assume it does.
Why assume that? Why, we're not making any assumptions.
Well, you're making assumption it does not stop.
Well, the actual teachings suggest that there's no change for people who have achieved the state of selflessness, that there's no fundamental change at death.
There's
nobody to die, so the physical body dies. But the notion of somebody being there as an identity is not a question because there's no identity.
Right, that's the difference.
So, if you think about one of the things we do when we practice, it's a real legitimate, I think, objective is to realize in some ways we are preparing ourselves for death. It's not a morbidity or morose kind of topic we're talking about. It's just recognizing how do I cope with discontinuity, which is, you could say, what death is. And that happens all the time, right? We're constantly experiencing discontinuity. Things are constantly falling apart. The more we look, the more we see just continuous shifting and uncertainty. And so, the teachings are, for people who have achieved enlightenment and talk about it, is that there's fundamentally no change at death on the level of egolessness. And that's not considered a bad thing. As a matter of fact, it's considered rather positive.
I think what Michael raises is the sense that sitting right here now and trying to pin down the answer to your question is kind of the antithesis of what we're talking about, which is about somehow being fluid enough to be open enough to see what occurs. And working with your own mind with meditation practices and so on and so forth enable us to be supple and fluid and flexible, to just be open. Just as you get a flat tire, on a very mundane level, your universe doesn't come crashing down about you. You respond to what's occurring, and you engage with the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. I know they seem completely not unlinked together, but if we try to take this big, huge leap of what happens after we die, that's very... there's no answer to that we can pin down. Does that make any sense? any sense to it?
Yes. Interesting.
See, I think the, to me, just speculating, right? At the moment, that's the big discontinuity. That's the big dis. And I guess, you know, the chemistry would be that you drop something in a large ocean, you know, like the turtle we're going through, then it gets spread. It gets totally disorganized. That breaks the notion that somebody, that the nadons are going to circle, repeat themselves, so to speak.
Well, the nadons are happening because we perpetuate them. If we train to cut them, and we have very specific instructions, at least in terms of our discussion of the nadana so far, we know where we can cut them, right? Between craving and grasping, right? We have that point of where we actually can take step in and actually do something instead of just letting them continually take us over and just get carried away by the momentum. The point is, Eric is bringing up, is that as we learn more about the nature of mind, we're learning more about basic space. This will come up more and more as we go forward. When we talk about emptiness, we are basically talking about space. We're talking about openness. We're not talking about something that's solid and closed. We're talking about openness. So the understanding of working with our mind and working with our heart, working with our practice and our habits is to break up that and discover more and more open space. So as that goes on, my understanding and the teaching suggests that basically we merge with that great space at death. That's the possibility. We have that opportunity if we train ourselves in this, as opposed to just recycling these same things that we're looking at right now. They're right here, they're pointed out, and we can actually witness them in our own experience through practice. So, you know, we don't have to just have this go on continuously, this endless circling around in circles and circles, which, you know, create, as you bring up, conflict, right? The whole issue of...
Definition, yeah.
Yeah, just the whole issue of friction, conflict, separation, and isolation, and sadness and pain, right? Because we're separating instead of basically opening ourselves to what's really here.
We're going to just cover the nadanas briefly at the end, but you just reminded me of something, which is that when I was 16 and smoking cigarettes, I recognized that there was the opportunity that I thought and grabbed a cigarette. And this is how I quit, was I thought that I would smoke. I'd say, I'll think about it for 5 times. And then I'll grab the cigarette. And then after 5 times, I'll say, well, I'll just wait. And then I'll think about it 5 times more. So it was exactly that. And so this can actually be done. You can actually change your habitual way of responding in this life now here, and we'll talk about that, but that will come right after the skandhas. So here we are, if I may just to try to get through this a little bit. We've then discussed the 5 skandhas of form, feeling, perception, karmic formations, and consciousness. Took notes here. We can read that if you'd like, or just continue. The form, the momentary events we experience as physical elements, the 5 sense organs and the corresponding sense objects. Feeling, primitive sensations of positivity or negativity.
Or neutral. Any source you
That's
need.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Perception. Labeling rudimentary perceptions through our senses and thoughts. Karmic formations, some skaras. A conglomeration of all the habitual concepts, labels, and judgments, conclusions that have resulted from the previous skandhas. To consciousness, which is a very primitive, circumscribed, self-referential field of me, surrounded by, quote, surrounded by an electric fence, governed by a sense of self-protection and territoriality. We seduce what we like, reject what we don't like, or what threatens us, and ignore or don't even see that which can either help us or harm the construction of me. And then within this fifth consciousness, this fifth skanda, are the eight consciousnesses, which include the five sense consciousnesses, which are your eye consciousness, ear, nose, tongue, and body. They're concept-free. They only register the sense of experience. The sixth consciousness then follows with, it recognizes and registers mind's perception of mental objects. And here it's still conscious, concept-free. It registers mind's direct experience with an object. So I suppose what it would be like is red. What we've have we labeled it? Yeah. And are we drawn? We don't even know if we like it or don't like it. We just have a
awareness
of it.
It's the meditation. That's where we are when we're meditating. Right. When we're doing shamatha.
Is the sixth consciousness?
Is that right?
Well, it registers. It's also a function, the capacity to organize our perception. So we're not.
Right.
It's not like it's just this blank slate. It's more about a coordinating process.
Coordinating, right. All the other.
Without any identity here, we're just talking about a function of mind.
That's what I mean by concept free without identity.
We're not talking about concept entering at all. It's just like a circuit board which basically coordinates.
How do we don't walk into a wall.
How do we balance? Yeah, how do we balance ourselves? Yeah. When we see a stop sign, we stop.
Yeah.
Sort of like, you know, go through a metaphysical issue about it. And, you know, there's no question about just simply operating. It's just an operational kind of basis. So it helps us understand how fundamentally everything's a lot simpler than we tend to make it. And that's what we make is where we go next. The big deal.
The seventh consciousness.
Seven. Yeah.
The creator of duality.
Me,
mine. And I like that. Or so that actually your whole world becomes you. Mm-hmm. Because of manifestation of your ownership, almost. And that's where we get strongly into I like or I don't like.
Well, that's where we create things. That's where we create things. We reify.
Reify.
We make things. We create things.
Yeah. Imposes constructed self onto everything. Isn't that the Who?
Sounds a little bit like the
dance party happening.
So the eighth consciousness then is the Alaya, the storehouse consciousness. All experiences leave an impression of minute by minute, lifetime to lifetime, resolved. And I loved how in the reading it said, this is resolved through the natural occurrence of one's suffering or through spiritual practice. So I thought that was really kind of interesting, that the view of suffering is as a resolution to this collection of. So do we think it resolves in suffering or because of suffering?
There are people who claim to have broken through to a major opening through tremendous suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Eckhart Tolle is one of those. He talks about that. And I think that is it's less common than spiritual practice, but it is apparently one route to liberation.
Well, we see people. We see people experiencing catharsis, and so I don't think it's all that uncommon. There are many. I mean, maybe it's not an everyday occurrence, but there are people who have dramatic breakthroughs in their life as a result of encountering and having to process some extraordinary shock or trauma or other kind of issues that they've had to carry, and sometimes the tragic, at least outwardly, but. You know, oftentimes people who have meet with real tragedy, and they're very cheerful, like they've lost the use of their arms or legs or something, and they feel fantastically. You know, they're very positive about their experience, which you could say that's a breakthrough on some level too. So, I don't know, but I think that we have the option of not only having to suffer. That isn't the only route we have to choose to or go through to actually liberate karma. And the point about spiritual practices being the key point is that we can just do this every day and contribute toward that lightening up and opening
Mike,
up.
Mike, will you have something?
No. Look around.
Oh, you're looking around. So, we have a question.
Yes. So I'm a little bit confused with the term karma. I thought karma is don't do what you don't want done to you. So can you explain karma in this?
Good luck.
Well, karma is basically cause and effect. Karma is, you know, actually, for every action there's a reaction, or for every kind of action there is a response. We're talking about karma as being a series of linked actions that bring about certain kinds of results. These results aren't necessarily solid. They are also in a state of flux. It's not like just A plus B equals C and that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. It's more about that's the process. We're looking at more of a process. And we do have karma going on all the time in everything, the way things work. I mean, we have a personal karma, we have national karma, we have business karma, we have school karma, learning karma. You know, all kinds of karma is basically engaging, relating to something and seeing the effects of that on some level. But when we talk about karma as being an entrapment, that's more about what we talk about here in this context.
What
do
you
find ourselves entrapped?
Yeah. Sorry? What were you thinking?
I didn't have anything in particular.
You know, there's so many different ways you could look at it. For example, if you drink and you drive, then the result could be you're injuring yourself or somebody else, or you. So you could say that on a certain level, you know, the karma of you drinking too much leads you to get in a car accident. You could say that, but you could also say that that you were drinking too much because of what came before that. Somebody, you know, you had a terrible family situation or whatever. So that the karma isn't sort of like a one-off. Like if I do this, then that's going to happen to me. It's more of a... it's interconnected with
various causes
and conditions of your whole life. You had the karma of your life to actually bring you to this class. You could look at it that way.
So it's everything that's happened in the world to bring you to this moment, and that's more than we can understand.
But we can always talk.
Yeah. Still talk about it.
No, I get it. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I hope that we will get to the 12 Madonnas.
Yeah, let's get it.
Okay. Okay.
We're only in 10 minutes.
Okay.
Left. We gotta
get to really fast. Okay, I'm going to be really fast. Okay, then the eighth consciousness, the Alaya, and I just want to read one thing. One moment of consciousness with the Alaya as its most subtle level carrying our particular karma dies, which I thought was a really interesting sentence, which I can't remember where I read it, but I thought it was fascinating.
What dies?
The consciousness.
The consciousness?
Yeah, yeah, okay. It's the idea that there's a succession of moments of consciousness, each of them dies and is replaced by the next.
Okay. I just thought that was really an interesting beginning. Okay, so I'll just quickly go over the 12 Madonnas because we really want to get to the bar.
Party.
Yeah, get to the party.
We're not going to get to the mental factors.
Right, okay. So we've got
mental factors.
No, we worked really hard on those mental factors. So then we went over the 12 Madonnas, ignorance, formation, consciousness, name, and form, six sense fields, contact, feeling, craving, grasping, becoming, birth, old age, and death. Repeat.
I have a question about this.
I'm sorry?
I have a question about this. There's like an order here, right? Like they, or are they just 12 things, but or are they like linked
No, it's,
in order?
It's actually a sequence.
Right.
Yeah.
That kind of, it's links. Actually, the word nidana means links, like links on a chain. So everything is giving birth, giving rise to the next nidana. That nidana in turn gives, that's why we can cut it at different points. We actually can, you know, actually insert in a moment of awareness the capacity to see the situation and actually change the flow as opposed to just going. This is the automatic when we see. And somebody, when a situation is an automatic, that's the nidana.
Okay, so what happens when they go to the bar?
All right, let's do that. All right. Does somebody want to read?
We could go around.
Why don't we go around? Okay. Elise, you're the...
I'll be ignorance.
Go right ahead.
Oh. So ignorance, enter the door, don't know anyone, no reference point, freeze, go numb, heightened self-consciousness.
So we've all been there.
We are all there continually.
We are all there continually.
Oh, that's good.
I don't understand what we're doing. Can I just choose any order?
There's no choice.
We don't pick and choose.
Oh, yeah.
You don't get to pick your favorite Nadal.
Formation. Sorry. Can't stay at the door all night. Must do something. Impulse to find a landing spot. Vision narrows to find a reference point. And head for the bar.
Okay, so you walked in the door and it's like, oh, geez. I'm going to go to the bar. Okay.
Consciousness, have now made it into the party, but need to nourish yourself. Oral compulsion, have a drink.
Okay, decided to do that.
Name form, feel warmth pervading body, feel fortified, empowered in body, feel more expansive.
Six senses, survey the situation, look for someone to talk to.
Does anybody want to elaborate at all at this point, or do we just keep going? All right.
Contact, see someone interesting who catches your eye.
Feeling, person looks good, attractive, worthy of our attention, we feel good. Craving, desire to talk to them, engage them, irresistible impulse, so lonely.
Grasping, mind is fixated on how to approach them, can't ignore them. Already?
What's the already?
Yeah, that's the
can't ignore them already.
I think it's already when you can't ignore them, you are becoming.
Okay.
Already becoming.
Yeah. I see. Okay. Coming, go over to talk to the person. Yeah.
Birth, get to know the person. Give birth to a relationship.
Aging and death. Sounds like a tough conversation. Challenging anyway. Conversation. Focus starts to flag. Well, a little boring. Right? Let's look the other way. Diffuse, interrupted, reference point dies. Gap. Ooh, no one to talk to.
Gap again. There you go. Yeah. So we're back.
Oh, I see. So ignorant, and yes, we've looped around to ignorance.
Right. Ignorance again. So here we are again. Ignorance. Because there's nobody to focus on, we're suddenly at this wide open space.
Right.
Again, what do we feel? We panic. We go numb again. We have a heightened sense of self-consciousness and of our own aloneness. And then?
Formation. head back to the bar for another drink, etc.
Michael is already
Michael.
You can make up.
Oh no,
he's going to go into
consciousness.
Oh, so the idea is that the cut can be when you realize, oh, that person looks really good. I'll go over because I'm just so lonely. You say, nah, not today. Is that where that
between,
cut is?
I think it's between
craving and grasping.
So you see them and you're like, they're really interesting, but then you say, but I don't really need that.
Yeah,
I'm not going to go get it.
Reggie Raybould puts it in feeling and craving, but I think it's...
In our meditation practice, as we practice right now, we can basically... That's the point of insertion between craving and grasping. However, as we do more Mahayana practice, we can go backwards. When we talked about bringing up the 12 Nidanas, you can actually go back and take back your projection. You can actually undo them. And as we undo them, we step further back into the cycle of the sequence. We don't have to wait for another one to get all the way back up to craving and grasping before we do another snip or attempt to do that. We can continue moving towards that. Ignorance is the most profound and most difficult one because that is something that we don't even, as what's his name so famous, Donald Rumsfeld saying, there are known knowns and unknown knowns and unknown unknowns. There are certain things we don't know that we don't know. And those kind of ignorances are very profound, and we can only actually engage our lives to explore what that means. I mean, that's part of the deal. But we don't have to turn this into a neurotic process. This is the whole point.
And to your point, I found this quote as well, that Hinayanists cut the linkage between old age and death. Mm-hmm. Bodhisattvas reverse the chain, mm-hmm. draining the reservoir of ignorance. Mm-hmm. So that's back to what you were just saying.
I mean, at that point, ignorance becomes more pure potential. It's right. Simply the potential of pop. We don't know, our potential is limitless. We don't know the extent of our potential. This is the fantastic thing about our own inner possibilities and why it's so important that we have fundamental faith in oneself in order to really do this. I mean, because, you know, and as we learn how to trust ourselves more through the practice, more opens.
And you could, if you just think about how would this be enlightened, this whole cycle, you could imagine right at ignorance, you could just walk in and just not be looking for anything and just be open to the situation.
Just being in the open space without
self-reference point or clinging or... But there is always that kind of momentum because there's an uncomfortability and, you know, referencing back all the time to self.
So I think what I was under the misconception that the goal was to just simply be okay hanging out in space, which on the ultimate level, certainly. But on the active level is that right now, in our existences, to experience that and to actively not act is exactly what we can do. So that's actually the action.
Sometimes it's being with the uncomfortable
being with the uncomfortableness and acknowledging it's uncomfortable.
Oh, and that came about because, working backwards, because something died leaving this gap in my mind, so I can go backwards through this. So we have time to, we could go around going backwards.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yes.
On the FAK. Okay.
But I think we're...
He wants to read the word
backwards. Now we ran out.
We're 9 o'clock
going backwards.
But it does occur to me that this would be something that would be really fun for you to create you can act this out.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, this is exactly, you know, would be brilliant.
Dramatize
it. I would love to see it.
Fun.
So you could
give us all parts.
You're the one to do it. We could do that. Didn't we do that?
We'd have the self, like, getting harder and harder.
Yeah, right.
We could make it a musical.
musical.
Somebody playing over there.
Everything is set in. This is played in every single story.
Right.
It's happening all the time.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's true. But we celebrate the crazy. We love that passion. Mm-hmm. And we love that aggression. Don't we? We just love it. Yeah. Culturally, we're just intoxicated by it. So we can't finish this. We've got some scones here for you.
Oh, not them again.
I mean, realms. Well, I mean,
we already have enough scones.
We've had scones. I mean, realms and mental factors. So they're all yours.
So hit save when you go home on the computer.
I will, and I'll send it to you.
Right. So you should post this. Yeah.
Good. So I hope this was a helpful
experience. Thank you so much for the summer.